So I welcome myself back. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the default teacher. When there isn't somebody else here, I'm the one that's here. And so it's been a nice 6 weeks away. I started to write the Urban Buddhist book that I was intending, and not that it's anywhere close to completion, but at least it has a few chapters to its credit. So I look forward to working on that in the course of this year. And so I appreciate coming back. It was a nice feeling of warmth and gathering again together like this and seeing old faces, not old faces, but familiar faces. Very nice. And it's also nice to tackle this subject. Although I'm sure some of you out there think, oh God, the hindrances, right? Hindrances in teacher lore, when you're a brand new teacher and they want to test you on the stage of the audience, they give you the hindrance talk to do because they figure you can't mess it up. Because you've heard it so many times that it's pretty much you're pickled in it. So I don't want to do that. I want to look at this thing fresh. It's actually a tremendous, depth to the hindrances. And if we look at it from what we've heard, perhaps we've heard many talks on it, look at it very superficially. And this particular tradition can take hindrances as being a real problem. In fact, many of the techniques and depths of samadhi practice that this tradition uses is to sort of put the hindrances into abeyance so they won't bother us, so that we can get on with our meditation. It's a little bit like how we sit in a very quiet spot and anything that, you know, the motorized vehicle or the jackhammer or the airplane even, you know, it's a disturbance, and so we try to find a different spot that can eliminate even those disturbances, and pretty soon we're in some cave in the Himalayas. And I think that that's the wrong way to approach this. Rather, it's to take on the difficulties and see what they are, and to eliminate the conflict and struggle with difficulties, and that's what a free mind is. I was offering the beginning class series, first class last night, and I said to people, you know, yes, find a quiet place to sit in your house, but your primary obligation is to be flexible to whatever the disturbances are to that quietness, to that half an hour that you're dedicating yourself to practice. So that if you're sitting and someone rings the doorbell, your primary purpose is to be flexible enough to answer the door without feeling irritated that you have to disturb your sitting. Right? We don't hold on to the sitting, and everything else is a disturbance to that. It's the flexibility of mind, the ability to accommodate disturbances and the unexpected, which is a free mind. So we can become more captive by the mind if we become less flexible in our meditation. And it's worth remembering that, because many of us do just that as we try to build walls which ultimately act as boundaries to ourselves and the world around. So this question of hindrances, if we think we have to be liberated only after the hindrances subside, I'd like to give you a Buddhist story that is anything other than that. And that's the very common story of Angulimala. Angulimala in Pali means a ring of fingers. A mala, like mala beads, a ring of fingers. And this particular criminal had killed 499 people in the Buddhist time. He was looking for his 500th, and lo and behold, he perceives a monk. He says, oh, that'll be a great 500th killing. But unfortunately, it was the Buddha that he was that he had spotted. And so he starts running after the Buddha. And the Buddha, if through his psychic powers, continues to walk very slowly, and Angulimala is unable to catch up or to close the distance between himself and the Buddha. And so he yells out in frustration, "Stop, monk, stop." And the Buddha says, "I have stopped. It's you that hasn't stopped." And at that moment, it is said that Angulimala awakened. That's with 499 murders on his... So I don't think the hindrances were in abeyance with him. And yet, the ability to perceive the truth through all of that. Now, if that's myth, quite likely it is. Who kills 500 people and not gets caught, right? Not very many people. But it doesn't matter. What he's saying here is something that is very valid to what we're talking about. And that is, in the midst of all this turbulence, in the midst of all this confusion and hatred and anger, is there a way to perceive and pierce all of that so that we can move to the truth, to the depth of our being? And if you read any of the Zen stories, these Zen scoundrels that are forcing people to stay outside the gates of their monastery in the snow and won't give you the time of day and just kind of are these curmudgeons. they look like they're full of hindrances to me. I was with Nisargadatta Maharaj in 1980, and he had that feeling to me, just a total curmudgeon. He'd yell at me, and he didn't have any teeth. He'd take this towel and wipe his nose, and he's just a slob. And I was a refined monk. And so there was this huge distance, gulf between us as I showed him my refined ways and he showed me his hindrances. But it was a deep, but he had me cross that gulf because it was my ways that were the hindrance, not his. And as we began to look at character, I don't spend a lot of time encouraging character because I think character pretty much takes care of itself as we move into self-allowance and the different tools and using the different tools in meditation. I think there's a natural kindness that arises and character develops around the practice in a very wholesome and skillful way. But that doesn't mean that there aren't edges to that character where we get where we can see a very different character in one meditator as opposed to another, and we're not trying to homogenize everyone to be just the same. And those characters, you can often stand back and you think, is that person angry or are they frustrated or are they annoyed or what's going on there, and how can that be a free mind? But if the character isn't recoiling in the pain of contraction, then it can certainly display anything it wants to and have a free mind. It's only when that character has a particular view and contraction around itself, so that it's holding a pain, both a psychological and a perhaps physical pain of contraction, that it disembodies that freedom. But freedom itself doesn't really care what the character we have is. It doesn't weigh in on one character being more valuable than another. It just shines. And if whatever character we have is relaxed and fluid enough, then that light will shine through our character. Now, it's helpful to use the precepts here because the precepts sort of align our character to a kind of harmony with things so that whatever character we have isn't out of alignment, isn't in discord with the natural occurrence and resonance of things. So it's not to suggest that I'm encouraging non-perceptual action. I'm encouraging just the opposite. But again, I fully believe that Nisargadatta Maharaj was perceptual and ethical in perhaps far deeper ways than I could imagine. But that didn't keep him from being a curmudgeon. And so there, again, let us give our character credit. Let us relax a little bit around it. That this series on the hindrances and these rather insurmountable conditioning called the hindrances, these deeply thick-skinned conditioning tendencies that we have. I often think of it as like some householder in Mongolia who spent most of his or her life out with, you know, shepherding whatever they shepherd in Mongolia. And the skin is thick and wrinkled, and you can just feel that kind of encrusted from the sky and the light and the sun and the weather. That's a little bit like the thickness of the patterns of the hindrances. They get, they're so deeply ingrained within us. They're so strongly identified with that we have to relax a little bit with this thing. We can't take them as too upsetting. And we can dance and play with them a little bit rather than taking them as some indication that freedom is not possible as long as I have this reactive pattern, as long as I'm as sleepy, as restless, as doubting, as on and on I go. That there's nothing, there's no change, there's no accommodation, there's no growth that's possible. Nonsense. 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 The better question is, what view are we in when a hindrance is when a hindrance does arise? What view are we in? That is, are we in the view of connecting, of interconnectedness with that? Or is it outside of our practice, so something that we have to get over? Or do we bring it into our practice, something that we accommodate within it, that we connect with within it? And so these hindrances are opportunities, extraordinary opportunities. They're like the opportunity that death has. Opportunities are potentially, the opportunity for growth is directly proportional to the difficulty of the conditioning. So you can take a subject like death and dying and you can see the potentiality of growth within that, because there's no greater conditioning fear that we have than with that subject. But you take the hindrances, you still have this heat conditioning, and the potential for us to grow in relationship to these hindrances is proportional to that hindrance. It also makes it that much more difficult, but who cares? What do we have? But time to look. That's all we need. It's time to observe. Keep weighing in on the comparison and the judgment, the self-judgment, and how we're doing and how well we've come and how much anger we still have and how much this and that. Well, if that's the problem, that's the problem. Now, it doesn't mean that the hindrances don't have mental limitations when we're in the wrong view. When we're in the wrong view, it's all about us. The tiredness, the restlessness, the greed, the aversion, the doubting, it's all about us. And it weighs in very heavily from unwise view. But with wise view, what is about? Please, someone show me something that's about us within wise view. In fact, nothing is about us in wise view. Nothing. Are your clothes? It's like the clothes on your body. Are they about you? So to the hindrances within wise view and wise intention, which is, means that I'm not trying to get over these problems, but really looking at these energies and sometimes having to move with them. Sometimes we feel like we're building a dam in a very fast-moving stream to the hindrance, to the power of the hindrance. The best strategy sometimes is to move along with the waters. Flow with it. Flow with it. Act it out. I often suggest people who feel like they have spiritual tantrums to go out into the forest somewhere where no one can hear you or see you and throw things. And do it in an exaggerated way until a smile comes to your face. And if you're drowsy, just exaggerate. Curve your shoulders. Dip your head. And just walk around like, almost like a monkey. You know, just get a kind of lightness with it until a smile comes to us. I think that exaggerating conditions like that help us develop a kind of proportionality with them. So tonight, I want to spend most of the talk on the first hindrance, which is the hindrance of desiring. But I mostly, in talking about that, before I do, I want to honor how compulsive these hindrances are in our daily life, in the meditation and outside. It's not as if we only have hindrances when we sit. That's the only time we hear about them. But that's not the only time they're there. They're there all the time. Where are we when we have a greed attack or an aversive attack or whatever? They're around all the time. And they're always in service to the principles of pleasure and pain. Hindrances are in the service of pleasure and pain. They reinforce, if we're in wrong view in relationship to those hindrances, those obstructions of mind, then what we try to do is to solve the problem by bathing or indulging in pleasure and by avoiding the painful mental state that they are. So they're pleasure-pain driven, which is important to know, just to get a sense of this. Also, it's difficult to concentrate in the middle of these hindrances. When you're sleepy, when you're restless, when you're doubting, etc. It's difficult to focus in or to take the practice seriously. It seems like it's just going, it's dispersing in front of our eyes. So, if suffering is not caused by the hindrance itself, where does it begin? Well, I like to use different phrases, different ways to invite us to look. And tonight I want to invite us to look at suffering is the desire for more options than reality is offering. So that throws a different slant on it, you see. I like to do that because when we provide a different slant on a truth, we can begin to perceive it and perhaps investigate it in a different way. So desire is a hindrance because it's essentially fanning out the possibilities of the options available to us. The one that's here at hand is not the one we want. That's why we're desiring away from it. When we desire, it's away from something. So there's an aversive component to desire. And oftentimes there's a malaise or a discontentedness or a lethargy or something that leads, it stimulates the need to desire. Now just follow this in your own practice, using your own experience. So what does the mind do, you see? The mind does something very cunning. It circles back in on itself. It comes back in. It becomes self-conscious of its own pain. This is the whole problem. Freedom is freedom from that circling back in, that self-consciousness, that hovering sense of second-guessing ourselves and knowing what's going on. But the desiring mind hovers back. It weighs in on what the reality of the situation is, the uncomfortableness of the moment. And because it's so encased in wrong view, it identifies with that uncomfortableness, and it sets up a whole scenario of other options. I can get up, I can move, I can scratch the itch, I can wait this thing out. I mean, the options are endless. And it gives more reality to those options than it does to the reality of the pain. The painful option is not a possibility. Staying with it, says the desire, is not an option. Fanning out the other possibilities and picking one that invites an energetic response, that's the option. And so we pick our options from a variety of choices. We weigh in on the one we want, and we just do whatever we can do to maneuver our way towards that possibility. Meanwhile, reality only has one option. It's not as if reality has options. I hope we understand that. There are no options in reality. There's just this. If you think there are, you're in wrong view. And that mind that comes back in and says, well, what do you mean? Why can't I, it's too dark in here. Would somebody give me a brighter, and can I turn this up? And what about all that? Where is all that? In the moment. In the moment, where is all that? It's only a mental play of choices. And yet we take those as being real, and so we lose our footing within the reality that is manifesting and towards the options of the way reality could be manifesting. The distance, the gap between those two is suffering. And we do it all the time. We do it all the time because we're always circling back in on ourselves, taking one step away from ourselves, developing options for the reality and for ourselves, and then moving in accordance with the push of that desired outcome. And we think that's a life. That's a hovering. It's like trying to read with somebody looking over your shoulder all the time. It's annoying. And there's no abiding there. There's no integration into it. Life is to be lived from the inside rather than from the outside looking in. So this sense of desire, when we live with it enough, and let me just say, which I've said many times before, our culture induces that need, induces those options. I mean, it has too many options. The choices are endless in this culture. Endless. We were at a tile store. We're putting some tile down in our floor. And it's like, for size and color, and we'll walk into the store and I have this huge sense of just, I can't do this. Doubt. So from the hindrance, initially I get all enthusiastic about having a different floor. I walk into the tile store and she goes, ugh. It's like, that's what the feeling is. This kind of feeling of I'm not up to the task of this. If I lived with that, and all the choices that are, go to a store and look at the choices of breakfast cereal. Or anything. Like, who can decide any of that? So, all of that is meant to keep us fractured, to keep us undivided, to keep us, circling back in ourselves, questioning ourselves. So that we'll try new options, more options, a variety of options. And that is the problem. That is the problem. So this sense of lacking, as we go through our day and this feeling of just not being up to the task of living because of the options and never making the right choice because we have other choices that we could have made, and our mind plots out what could have happened had we made those other choices and how much better off we'd be. In fact, there's a whole thing called post-decisional regret. When you do make a decision, you get lost in the regret of the other 10,000 options. And that takes its toll, doesn't it? That sense of lacking takes its toll. And if we live with that as an ongoing experience of our life, which we all do, very few of us get through life without feeling or holding an attitude of lacking about ourselves, because it begins to condense into an attitude and it begins to assume the person is lacking, not the situation. I am lacking. And so from there, it's defeatism. It feels like we're just, that we just barely have the spirit to live. And the way we try to counteract that growing sense of lethargy is to look for more options, which is just the reverse, which is really the problem. You see, it's very interesting when we start talking about desire. Listen to the paradoxes of it. From wrong view will always take us deeper and deeper into the problem, and it uses the solutions that reinforce the problem. And so desires, the solutions to desires are the problems that desire actually causes. And those paradoxes aren't seen through. It's like what happened at Virginia Tech, you know. And then I heard this whole thing on the radio from gun control, people who are gun enthusiasts, of how this confirms their need to have the right to bear arms. Whereas I think it proves just the opposite, but they seem convinced that, you see, it's, when you're in that logic, the logic just reinforces itself on and on again. So desire, when it isn't perceived correctly, when it isn't, it really starts fostering other hindrances as secondary hindrances. Like, for instance, when we live with a kind of lacking, aversion, which is the second hindrance, starts acting, we start acting from the aversion of the lacking towards leaning into desire, but never realizing that really the leaning into desire is to get rid of the lacking. And so there's a secondary cause, reinforcement of another hindrance, which is the aversion. Or we start developing anxiety, residual fear of not having enough. When we feel lacking and we see that people have more than we are, and we start developing the comparison and jealousy and envy of all of that, there can just be this pervasive feeling of anxiety, of living with a sense of being diminished in relationship to what life could be and should be holding for us. And the melancholy and the pity that comes from all of that. And then, because there are so many choices, when we feel the deep, strong sense of lacking, there can be this restless worry about which choices to choose. And some of us get frozen like deer in a headlight when we have choices to make, because we ourself is at stake here. If we don't choose the right one, it just confirms the worst case scenario about ourselves, is that we're not sufficient enough to choose. We're not adequate enough to choose the right way. And so there could be this kind of turmoil and restlessness and agitation, also stimulated by this sense of feeling that lacking. You want to get away from it. And energetically, it's like getting too close to the flame. You just want to give yourself some fresh air. And so restlessness can become a component. You see how they all feed off of one? One feeds the other hindrances. And then there is doubt, of course, because first let me go to sleepiness. We can implode as well as explode. Restlessness is sort of the exploding of energy to get out of the thing. But also, equally, we can implode. We can feel dull and lifeless and sort of drifting. I know we probably have all had the experience of sitting in meditation and just feeling like we're drifting through the sittings and just flirting with the practice a little bit because there's such dullness, such a heavy state of dullness in us. Because we just aren't up to even risking anymore the possibility of failure. Also stimulated from a life lived through desire. And finally, of course, is the great hindrance, doubt, where you just don't believe we're up to the task. And when we're given an insurmountable task like freedom, I mean, what is that? That doesn't sound like anything I could even approach. It's so interesting because it's so approachable. And I hope that there's not a soul here that doesn't feel that after the number of years we've been together, the approachability of this thing. That it isn't a distant land. It is not a distant land. And so we have to ask the all-important question is, what is the payoff of all these choices? Why do we keep moving our mind into more and more choices? Why do we keep fanning out instead of just dealing with the reality at hand? Well, we like the choices. We don't like what's at hand. That's the obvious answer, isn't it? And we like to be in control of our choices. And reality gives us no sense of control whatsoever. It's a take it or leave it reality. And how are you going to leave it except mentally? So we mentally decide we're going to leave it. And in that mental leaving, we can then make choices for ourselves. So we opt out. It's really a suicide. You wonder when we opt out of problems like that, why major problems that we perceive are avoided, like global warming. And I feel as the issue becomes more apparent, more denial around the issue. In fact, I heard on the radio that 1 in 4 college-educated people, no, 3 out of 4 college-educated people do not believe in global warming for whatever reason, I don't know. 3 out of 4 college-educated. So that leaves 1/4. Why? Because why? It's too much. We'd have to give up too much. It's like death. We'll just forget about it. Just leave it let alone. I'd rather just die suddenly and not have to think about it. So I'd rather just have it all kind of implode on us, get warm, and I just won't think about what my children's lives will be in this. See, we can't do this. We can't do denial. We can't do denial intrapersonally. We can't do it interpersonally, and we can't do it environmentally. There's no opportunity for denial here. Denial, there's no room for that in our lives anymore. If denial is your choice of defenses, Dharma isn't for you. Because it takes you right to the issue. And if you're not willing to look, that's whether we're going to be dharmic in that moment or not. Whether we're going to meet what the fact is, meet it head on, or whether we're going to glance away and pretend it's not there. One is a Dharma alignment, the other is worldly living. Uh, I wonder why we never ask, is the promise of what desire says will happen, if I pursue my choices, in other words, whether that promise is ever fulfilled. You would think that we would ask that question seriously. That does this thing have the payoff that I thought it was going to have? And you can take anything. You can take your most cherished desire and ask that question from it. It doesn't hold up. In fact, if it did, the Dharma would be negated. The fact that it doesn't and cannot hold up to your scrutiny assures the survival of the Dharma. So we shouldn't be afraid to ask it. We just don't want to ask it because we don't want the cherished ideal to be taken away. That's why we don't ask it. But we should start asking it, don't you think? Is this all that good? Is this all that great? I mean, you can't help but be forced to the conclusion and see that it's not. And then the whole thing starts turning around to be credible. When we don't ask that question, nothing's credible. Nothing can line up. So what is the pain of the choices? What's the pain of having so much choices? Well, we have reality, and then we have our choices. And as long as we do not begin to accommodate reality, we feel the rub of the energetic need to have our life different than the reality, than what is grounded in the reality of the moment. That is painful. Do we notice that? Do we notice the pain of a desire? The pain of the lacking? Are we willing to look at that pain? So it's interesting. Now I want to just talk a little bit about a couple of the paradoxes because I really like the fact that desire tries to build upon its own logic. And because we don't look at the truth of the logic, we keep pursuing it, even though it gets more and more painful to pursue. So the mind engages in a particular activity to bridge what it feels like it needs. It sets an ideal standard and then it engages in an activity to do that. Like, I want a cookie. Right? I want a cookie. And what we are looking for is the peace, the satisfaction that happens when we have a cookie. We're not really looking for the cookie. That's a hard one. We're looking for the satisfaction of having eaten it. I've tried this. You have to play like this. You have to play like this. So I said, okay, cookie. Now I said, okay, I'm going to try this thing. I chew it, but I don't swallow it. I just chew it and then I spit it out. I said, that should be satisfying because everything is happening in the mouth and the flavor. What does the swallowing add? Doesn't add anything, does it? So I should be able to just chew it and spit it out. It should be like gum. But gum isn't very satisfying, isn't it? Somehow we have to ingest it, don't we? We're looking for the peace of the ingesting. It's very interesting. Why? Why should that be so? What we're really looking for, which is why we have to ingest it, is the end of the desire to have it. And it's only through the ingestion that that desire is satisfied, not through the chewing, because that isn't the full assimilation of the cookie. So what we're really looking for is not the taste. I proved that. It's the end of the desire. So we use desire to take us away from pain so that we can end the desire and find peace. Does that make sense to anybody? You see the paradox of this whole thing? And so we just keep, and then of course we do have a moment of satisfaction in which the cookie is ingested until we want another cookie or something else starts moving out. And then we're in pursuit, never knowing or seeing the pain of the discontentment that's driving the desire. The pain of the discontentment is what the desire is trying to satisfy by assimilating it into its body, into oneness, really. But we have divided ourselves out of oneness so that we can have the desire and pull it into ourselves and then have oneness through ingestion rather than through the natural harmony and natural condition of things. Now I find that pretty interesting because the whole thing is so skewed. It's so insane when we begin to see it. And the paradox is so evident. And the limitation of that range of activity and the inevitable frustration that will arise again and again and again when the pain that's driving the desire isn't being perceived or isn't being accommodated. Now, as meditation students, we try to accommodate everything. But first we have to know what's going on in order to accommodate it. First we have to be aware of the discontentedness, the sense of lacking that drives the desire. So if we can be aware of the lacking and just create space for it without it being so personally about me, then what we find is a resolution of the need to fulfill ourselves, which was only there because we wanted to get over the lacking that we are now accommodating. So the whole thing, you see, when you start bringing it into awareness, consciousness, when we're driven from something, it is paradoxically absurd. When we bring consciousness to the thing, the true resolution, the true possibility of the resolution is at hand. It's even worse than that, and another paradox. The mind, in order to have the world, has to disassociate itself from the world. It has to crack itself open and separate itself. That's what it does when it circles back in on itself with choices. It essentially takes something that's whole and unified and breaks it in two. And then it goes searching for a way towards wholeness, which it does through desiring the world. It seeks the world for the completion of itself. That's why desires occur. And yet it broke itself apart from the inherent completion in order to seek completion. Doesn't make any sense, does it? I'm not going to buy that one anymore. I'm finished. I hope this... I'm saying this for all of us here. I'm not just saying it for me. What is going on here? Let me make it conscious. Let me be aware. Let me make it conscious. As soon as we break the world in two, then we have all forms of conflict and struggle and this and that and you and I and the turmoils of individual things trying to cooperatively live together. So we say to ourselves, okay, I'm on to desire. Now I want to, what am I desiring? Well, as the homework points you to, watch where your eyes alight. What your eyes light upon. Because often where they light is where there is some pleasurable experience that can foster and encourage desire. So without judging it, just become aware of the formation of from the pleasant sensations to a desiring movement and a sense of gain and acquisition, and a sense of becoming and the choices I have in order to acquire it, because it happens very quickly as we play that hand. And ultimately we come to the point that nothing is going to fulfill our sense of longing. Nothing. Because that sense of longing comes from the heart. It is not to be assumed externally. It is to be, we are to draw ourselves in through that sense of longing. Into the sense of longing itself. The longing is a pull back into itself, not as an encouragement to go out and look for a piece that's missing. It's a movement, an energetic movement to consolidate ourselves back into wholeness. That's what the longing is really pulling us to do. To be whole once more. To be whole. And the only way I can be whole is to deny no aspect of myself, to deny nothing. Every emotion, every attitude, just what it is. And then we look for that which is not and never has been diminished. I was with a patient once on their deathbed, and they were telling me about all the things they were going to lose. And I said to him, what haven't you lost? You've told me all the things you have lost on because of your illness and all the things you're going to lose once you die, but what haven't you lost? And for a moment, he went to a place in which he was whole, in which he hadn't lost anything. Nothing was gone. Nothing was missing. That's the point of meditation. That's where it's directing us. To go where we feel undiminished. And we have to go through layers and layers of the deeply thick-skinned conditioning that has led us to believe, to assume our inadequacy. But if we are determined, and we can hold this, and this determination is a kindness. It's not a struggle. It's a kindness. It's an accommodating. It's an allowance. It's a receiving. We can find that which is undiminished. And may we all safely move into that journey. Can we just sit for a minute or two? So as we sit, you see, are we at war with the hindrances, restlessness, sleepiness? What's going on in us? How big is our heart? How spacious? How accommodating? How steady is the determination towards wholeness? Wholeness denies nothing. We get very quiet when we get determined, very resolute. And we begin to intimate, to get a sense of that which is whole, is also very quiet. Okay, if you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to see what I can come up with as an answer or response. Yes. Yes. Yes, hindrances, yes.
Why do we get the image of Buddha in his mind, you know, turn those into rose petals? Because for me, rose petals are very fragrant,
right.
Beautiful.
Right.
It's interesting that he didn't, you know, turn it into like dead dried leaves. I mean,
yes.
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 That
very good question. It's right online. Okay, so give yourself some credit. The question is regarding the Buddha at the time of his enlightenment. It said that Mara, meaning the hindrance, he was having a multiple hindrance attack. And Mara was shooting arrows at him. Which he shoots arrows at all of us, doesn't he? I can't, I must, I have to, oh my God, you know, I want, I can't, I, all of that. I'm too tired to do this. And it said that as the arrows were taking flight, see, move this into, from metaphor to experience. As the arrows were taking flight, he became conscious of them. Unconscious. If you remain unconscious to that attack, the arrows would have stuck, meaning that he would have been an embodied person having doubt, an embodied person having a desire, an embodied person being restless, right? That's where the arrows stick, because they are not being seen for what they are, as just empty statements, empty states of mind. But because he was as aware as he was, there was nothing that the arrow could stick to. There was no self that the arrow could stick to. In fact, everything that came at him was then transformed into the whole, the quality of wholeness, of completion, not as something that needed to be done or even painful. In fact, when we are whole, the hindrances can no longer touch us, not because they don't arise, but because there's no one they can stick to. And therefore, there's no way to divide. The hindrance can only survive in a divisive world in which I want something. When there isn't that divisive, separating quality within the mind, when things are not seen as being this and that, then they have nothing. They pass through empty space, you might say. And I think that's the metaphor of the arrows changing to rose petals and landing very softly without any impact whatsoever. Yes. Right. Yes. It's a good point, and that is when a couple of days ago, the massacre on Virginia Tech's campus in Blacksburg, Virginia, occurred, she really surfed the web to try to figure out, to try and make some sense of it. It's nonsensical, isn't it? It's nonsensical. See, it's very important to understand that flinching. And there's a flinching that goes on there. We're very vulnerable when we don't know, when we feel exposed and potentially in the way of harm. Right? And because the mind has no security in that formation, in that posture, it tries to do whatever it can in knowledge to get some sense of why such and such occurred. And thereby, it can prevent defenses against sequential attacks happening, right? But what happens when it loses its vulnerability is that it then makes enemies of what it is that potentially could attack. 9/11 is a perfect example. When we're raw, exposed, now I'm not saying that we shouldn't defend ourselves. Just listen to what the mind does as it defends itself. That's the point of this. When we're exposed to the possibilities of such danger, we move from that vulnerability, actually react from that vulnerability, because the sense of vulnerability is so unformed. It's so susceptible to harm that it moves from that to a very staunch, righteous anger, which pinpoints a problem and then attacks the problem so that it won't have to feel the vulnerability. And that's what many of us felt in that moment of the Virginia Tech experience, was that raw vulnerability. This came out of nowhere. This could be in our own home. This could be in our own city. It was in our own city a few weeks ago at University of Washington. That this could be in our neighborhood. This could be anywhere. This could be in a store that we shop, right? What makes sense? Make sense of it quick so that we could, was it the Arabs, you see? I mean, can we point it to a particular local? Well, it wasn't. Now what are we going to do? Well, it was a loner, someone who didn't speak to me. So now I'm going to be on guard to look for loners who seem to be isolated. You see, and I'm sure now that all across the campuses in the United States, loners are getting signaled out, or whatever the profile of this particular person was, to make it safe now, to get back to our safety. The issue is really the security of the known as opposed to the vulnerability of the unknown. And yet the Dharma unfolds, listen carefully, in the vulnerability of the unknown, where control is not the certainty, when choices aren't possible. Again, that does not mean that we go to the worst sections of town and just lay our bodies bare. But mentally, how we frame our life, moving from security to security, that's the circling back. That's the self-conscious response, knowing what the next step is going to be and making certain before I take it that it's going to be a safe step, as rather than the faith of just taking the step. You see the difference? There, the Dharma is moving us into the step of the unknown. But you can see what we're up against. Up against is a tremendous need to feel that security, especially in this world when all the things we've counted on, our environment, our culture, our place in life, everything is being shaken here. I think we're going to find more of that conservative response, more of a sense of blame, more of a sense of pointing towards victims. Because of that, the shakier we become. Okay, so we have to stop now.